Have you had the undeserved kindness today, friends? It's April 28th, 2023, the time, 14:25 Eastern Daylight Time. I'm Ward Green. I'm with you here for the study for today. Before we start, from 1960, a song by Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely.
Dum, 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 dum.
From 1960, Roy Orbison, Only the Lonely. In our study yesterday, we had some discussion about the importance of the Sinaitic inscriptions as the only historic evidence, other than, of course, the Bible, for the exodus of Israel out of Egypt. Now, earlier, that is, in this article, Wild Road, we had an illustration that I didn't actually discuss, and it was one of the Sinaitic inscriptions, and it is translated, "Prayeth unto God the prophet, a hard great stone, hands sustaining Aaron Hur," where the words "upon" are left out, as well as the words "upon" and "his" are left out. So it could be read, "Prayeth unto God the prophet upon a hard great stone, his hands sustaining Aaron Hur." It could also say Aaron and Hur, because Aaron and Hur are two people in the Bible. So the word "and" is also left out. But from what we know about the Sinaitic inscriptions, they were written by Israelites who had just learned the language, in some cases, who were practicing their writing on inscriptions in the rock while they were sojourning in the wilderness for 41 or 40 years and some months. So, "Prayeth unto God the prophet upon a hard great stone, his hands sustaining Aaron and Hur," is what it says. And not only that, but there's a picture of a man. Evidently that's Moses with his hands upraised. And if we look for the corresponding scripture. Do we have it here? Let's see. Here it is. Exodus 17 and 12. When the hands of Moses were heavy, then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat upon it, and Aaron and Hur supported his hands. That's the evidence for that Sinaitic inscription having been made by the Israelites themselves, is that correspondence to Exodus chapter 17, verse 12. And from yesterday, we talked about the spring at Marah, which is from Exodus 15 and 23, where it says, they were not able to drink the water from Marah because it was bitter. And so that is why he called its name Marah. And we saw in the translated Sinaitic inscription corresponding to this event, the reference to the fact that the branches of a tree were thrown into the water at the spring. And that's how the waters were recovered so that they could be consumed. That was from our article. Here, this is from paragraph 7.2, or Wild Road, the article, paragraphs 7.2, which is chapter 7, paragraph 2. That's where that illustration that's the place from which it was taken. When we come to today's, or yesterday's, first of all, yesterday's mention here of the inscription of the spring at Marah, which was identified based on the shape which was given in the illustration, which depicted what actually appeared as two springs that were shaped as long bodies of water, narrow bodies of water that extended over some distance. That was part of the inscription. That's how the spring was identified by a traveler who was familiar with the site of Hawara, which was identified, therefore, as the spring at Marah, based on the scripture corresponding also to the two water springs in the translation, and the people at the two water springs kicketh like an ass, smiting with branch of a tree the well of bitterness he heals. Which, if we were to study, we don't have time to study all of the scriptures every single day. There just isn't time. But let's take today's proverb first today. It's from Proverbs 31 and 20, so that we can move on more efficiently here and get more covered. Her palm she has stretched out to the afflicted one, and her hands she has thrust out to the poor one. That's today's proverb, little children. Let's go back and look at Exodus 15:23. What happened when the water was too bitter for them to drink? Jehovah directed him to a tree, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. Exodus 15:25. So that is indeed completely in harmony with the passage at the place in the, it's called the mountain of Mokateb. Jebel Mokateb means mountain of Mokateb, which is the same as the Wadi Mokateb, because the valley and the mountain are together. The mountain stands beside the valley. So Wadi Mokateb, the valley of Mokateb, is the same place where there were thousands of inscriptions made by, as we now see, the Israelites. And the people were at these two water springs at Marah, as we see from the passage in Exodus, where the branch of a tree healed the waters at Marah. And the man who identified the spring was a man that was very familiar with that era, that place, that location, which was called in the days of more recent times, Hawara. And it is thus identified as Mara of the scriptures. So, and we also saw that Mr. Forster was able to identify the quadruped as a donkey based on the fact that he knew about this scripture about the donkey kicking from Deuteronomy 32 and 15. Evidently, that's how he guessed it. But it makes sense. We don't know a lot of other animals that kick like a donkey does. Or in the language of 1852, an ass would have been the word very probably that was used then. But even in the language of the older translations of the Bible as well, such as the King James, an ass was a very correct translation of the word donkey from the Hebrew to English, of course. So, and there's a footnote to this paragraph that we did yesterday, too, that I didn't cover. But I think we've got enough to cover today from paragraph 12 that we can leave that for now. The Sinaitic inscriptions are found at a number of locations in the Sinai Peninsula, in Arabia, as well as the Sinai Peninsula, and at Kadesh Barnea in the southern desert region of Israel. They thus follow the attested wilderness route that we derive from the Bible and historiographical study. The presence in them of hieroglyphic characters, and more especially of hieroglyphic characters with a size much larger than any found in Egyptian temples, or than are known to be native to Egypt, makes doubly certain, as we agree with Mr. Forster, that Israelites were the authors of the Sinaitic inscriptions, after having lived in Egypt, and Moses being learned in all wisdom of the Egyptians. However, critics may rightly demand, as unbelievers, a proof of the most specific kind, namely an inscription like the Rosetta Stone, which has the evidences of both the Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Old Arabic. When, as Mr. Forster so convincingly relates, the Arab guides of a certain Mr. Butler were asked at length as to, quote, to the existence of any other inscriptions of such a type besides those already known, end quote, they did at length, and after much and close inquiry, inform him that in a mountain cave halfway up Jebel Mahara, the mountain called Mahara, in fact, were such texts of the very kind of which he was in search. Indeed, halfway up this mountain, he was brought to the cave promised, the entrance of which was about 4 or 5 feet high, which he at once, disappointed, at first hesitated to enter. Whereupon, when he judged it better to try, he knelt down and found, cut on both sides, were plains, in other words, flat surfaces, in the mouth of the entrance. And on the right-hand side of it was a triple inscription, two columns of which were pure Egyptian hieroglyphics, the third column existing in pure Sinaitic characters. This was a thrilling discovery, no doubt. The Sinaitic inscription was illustrated by the hieroglyphic figure of an ostrich, with wings dye-spread, neck outstretched and mouth open, as in the action of running and flying. The disjecta membra of the ostrich reappear in the Egyptian portions of the tablet, in other words, the disconnected members of the ostrich, showing that there is a common subject. Those members appeared, those disconnected members of the ostrich appeared in the Egyptian portions of the tablet. That's from another book by Charles Forster, The Israelitish Authorship of the Sinaitic Inscriptions, 1856, page 62, from which also the illustration of the ostrich below here is derived. There has never been better evidence of Exodus, together with the corroboration of the myth of Phoenix and Cadmus in approximately 1500 BCE. Why is that? Well, because Camuti, the son of Apophis, who was the possessor of a throne name, Akinenri, and Cadmus being the son of Agenor, which is a similar name to Akinenri, Cadmus would then date to around 1533, the time of the Hyksos expulsion from Egypt. So that's about 1500 BCE, and our BG dating of 1493 BCE, which is for the Exodus, there's the corroboration there from of the myth of Cadmus, where Cadmus is in reality, according to this corroboration, he's Camuti, the son of Apophis. And because we have this inscription also in the Sinai Peninsula, in the Sinai Desert, by the Israelites, we have evidence of this alphabetic language, which was believed to have been the very earliest known alphabetic language, and that's how Cadmus brought this language to Greece in the myth that was describing this event as having been associated with the name Cadmus. There is no longer any reason to doubt the truth about the Exodus of Israelites with Moses from Egypt. This is very, very substantial now. We've substantiated it using inscriptions in the Sinai Desert. These inscriptions are not going anywhere. There were thousands of them in Wadi Mokateb, and that's just one place where there were inscriptions. There were many places. There's no way that all of those inscriptions can be rubbed out easily or at all. I mean, these are staying there. Finally, we have incontrovertible proof of the Bible's witness by independent testimony in signature. The signature has a footprint that fits Israel. This is the exciting and thrilling story of the Exodus as documented in the Sinaitic inscriptions here in chapter 7. And that's the end of chapter 7 of Wild Road, showing the wild ostrich here in the inscription that was discussed there by the investigator, the explorer, Mr. Butler, who was searching and searching for and found this triple inscription where it was possible, just like with the Rosetta Stone, to observe in more than one language the inscription, the same writing, you know, the same words being written in more than one language, just like we know about, which also happened with the Rosetta Stone. And this, but in the case of this particular inscription, there was a vivid illustration of an ostrich, a very vivid one. And the Egyptians didn't do this kind of artwork. They just didn't do it. They were superstitious. In the footnote 4 here, this is written by Charles Forster. It says, number one, the internal evidences suffice to show that this bird is not a work of Egyptian art. In the monuments of Egypt, it is true that the ostrich not unfrequently occurs. He wrote unfrequently. We would say infrequently today. That's the word we would use. It not unfrequently occurs among their hieroglyphics, but always in mere and miniature outline as a hieroglyphic character, and always, moreover, not singly, but in interlinked groups of three or four birds, uniformly running as the emblem of speed. The bird is never represented as a picture, and never, I believe, alone. In the hieroglyphic collections of Young, Champollion, Wilkinson, etc., I do not recall a single example of the ostrich save as a conventional hieroglyphic character or group. Like its counterpart, the camel, it seems to have been prescriptively excluded from pictorial representation and in all likelihood for the same reasons of superstition. Now, the uniformity of conventional usage in Egypt and its vital connection with religion plainly render departure from its rigid rules by native Egyptian artists a thing impossible. But the living portrait of the ostrich of the triple inscription is not more contrary to Egyptian usage than it is foreign from Egyptian art. Such a breathing copy from nature will be sought in vain throughout the monuments of the pharaohs. The artist indeed may detect a hidden grace, an expression lurking behind those dry conventional forms, but the realities of life and nature will ever be missing to the common eye. It is left with the general reader to determine whether these realities do not meet in the glyphograph of the ostrich prefixed to this chapter. Although, according to Mr. Butler, neither cast nor photograph can adequately convey the living, breathing expression of the original as seen by him upon the rock. It is specifically noteworthy that three ostriches, the usual conventional group, thus running at full speed, interlaced in the usual Egyptian style, mark the connection between this triple tablet and the hieroglyphics at Sarbut el-Kedem, as of common origin, and with a common object. This object, judging by the grand hieroglyphic ostrich, being to symbolize the wanderings of God's people. Since writing the above, see, that was a footnote to the idea of ostriches being an emblem of speed, always represented as three or four birds together running in the hieroglyphics of Egypt. So there were also hieroglyphics at Sarbut el-Kedem, which was with the object, according to that footnote, of symbolizing the wanderings of God's people, the ostrich symbolizing that. Now, the second footnote is a double asterisk, and it's the idea of only does the ostrich appear as a conventional hieroglyphic or as a group. Since writing the above, I discover a solitary exception in Wilkinson, the figure of an ostrich led by a string round the neck in a procession of Abyssinians, leading various animals supposed to be tributes to the pharaoh of the day. But the figure is hard and lifeless, without the least expression. The tablet in which it occurs, moreover, is on a foreign subject, wholly unconnected with Egyptian idolatry. From these internal proofs that the ostrich of the triple inscription could not have been the work of an Egyptian artist, we come next to the scriptural proof that the ostrich is the prophetic symbol of God's people, Israel. This is point number two, a point which, once established, authoritatively identifies any figure of the ostrich at Sinai of unquestionable Mosaic antiquity, as the ostrich of this triple inscription most unquestionably is, with Israel and the Exode. It's identified. The proof required is supplied by the prophet Jeremiah, who in a passage of his Lamentations connects the apostate Israel of his day with the ostrich and the ostrich with the wilderness in terms which irresistibly carry back the mind to apostate Israel in the desert and to the symbol of the ostrich. Certainly as old as the age of Moses, which stands a witness to the force of the prophecy of this day in the cave on Jebel Magara. It is with this glyphograph before us that we can realize his imagery, as without its aid we never could. The daughter of my people is cruel like ostriches in the wilderness, Lamentations 4 and 3. And there, at the bottom of the ending of chapter 7, we see the other illustration of this event that occurred at the springs of Mara, which it says it has the picture of the donkey drawn. In this case, the presence of the donkey is actually drawn in and not just noted in text by the man who transcribed it. And it's translated, the people with prone mouth drinketh at the water springs together. The people at the two water springs kicketh like a hornet stung ass renitently, which I believe means rebelliously. Okay, so we're going to go back now just to describe briefly this marvelous inscription of the ostrich, which I did a small amount of restoration upon in order to eliminate what looked like possibly a scratch on the artwork rather than a scratch on the original, but it could be either way, I suppose. But if we see this ostrich, it appears to be, well, its neck is diagonally from top left to middle right, projected upwards in the direction of the top left, in other words, but also its beak is slightly open, its eyes are squinting very tightly, and it was called its wing, it was described as wings die spread, so the wings were spread in two directions, which I can't quite make out in this particular drawing. Oh yes, it's die spread in the sense that it appears as though the wings are thrust into the forward, the foremost position. Although it's difficult to tell in a two-dimensional representation like this, because it also appears to be a profile view of the ostrich, where we're seeing only one side of the face of the ostrich, and also one side of the body. It's difficult to make out anything with regard to the feet of the ostrich in this particular engraving, but it's a very detailed, extremely detailed engraving. The details of the wings, the details even of the fur on the neck being of a very fine nature, down to the exact feather and so on. It's very minutely detailed in every way, with contrast being displayed throughout the wings and along the underside of the neck, so that there's a very dark shadow under the necks, so that it almost becomes three-dimensional in that sense. But even if it were three-dimensional, we can't see behind it, so it's not easily seen where that other wing is. But this ostrich is seemingly in the process of performing a very vigorous physical exercise of some kind. Okay, that's today's study in Wild Road, and I hope it was as exciting for you as it was thrilling for me. We're going to hopefully now look at something else here. Cadmus, this is a very exciting thing, that we know that the Siege of Sardis is documented in Wikipedia nowadays as being an event that occurred in 547 BCE when Cyrus conquered Sardis. 547, when we compare that to the dating in the Parian chronicle, a Greek chronicle, we see that that event occurred in that document in 549 BCE, which is not very different. 2 years different. And then when we look to the very beginning of this document, we can get a date for when Cadmus, according to this same Parian chronicle, when did Cadmus arrive at Thebes? In other words, bringing the very first alphabet to Greece. That date is calculated using the Parian chronicle as 1519 BCE, in our case we call it, or BC, but it's before the Common Era, is what BC stands for, which is the same thing as before Christ. So 1519 compared to 1533 for the expulsion of the Hyksos is very close and allows about 14 years for Camuti to arrive in Greece, if he did in fact go to Greece, or maybe he just went to Phoenicia and from there the alphabet made its way to Greece. But there's still an adequate amount of time there, and Camuti still could very well have been alive after merely 14 years since the expulsion from Egypt. So there we see that our chronology looks more than adequate as well, which is exciting. Okay, so now our Bible study for today. Well, we've done our proverb. That's right. And that leaves our reading from Exodus chapter 10. Little children, this is now further to the events of Moses and Aaron requesting Pharaoh to send Israel away out of Egypt. Then Jehovah said to Moses, go into Pharaoh, because I have let his heart and the hearts of his servants become unresponsive, in order that I may set these signs of mine right before him, and in order that you may declare in the ears of your son and your son's son how severely I have dealt with Egypt and my signs that I have established among them. And you will certainly know that I am Jehovah. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and said to him, this is what Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, has said. How long must you refuse to submit yourself to me? Send my people away that they may serve me. For if you continue refusing to send my people away, here I am bringing locusts within your boundaries tomorrow, and they will actually cover the visible surface of the earth, and it will not be possible to see the earth, and they will simply eat up the rest of what has escaped, what has been left to you people by the hail, and they will certainly eat every sprouting tree of yours out of the field, and your houses and the houses of all your servants and the houses of all Egypt will be filled to an extent that your fathers and your fathers' fathers have not seen it from the day of their existing upon the ground until this day. Filled with locusts, that is, not filled with food. With that, he turned and went out from Pharaoh. After that, Pharaoh's servant said to him, how long will this man prove to be as a snare to us? Send the men away that they may serve Jehovah their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt has perished? So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, go, serve Jehovah your God. Who in particular are the ones going? Then Moses said, with our young people and our old people we shall go, with our sons and our daughters, with our sheep and our cattle we shall go, for we have a festival to Jehovah. In turn he said to them, let it prove to be so that Jehovah is with you when I shall send you and your little ones away. See, on the contrary, something evil is your aim. Not so. Go, please, you who are able-bodied men, and serve Jehovah, because that is what you are seeking to secure. With that, they were driven out from before Pharaoh. Jehovah now said to Moses, stretch your hand out over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come up over the land of Egypt and eat up all the vegetation of the land, everything that the hail has let remain. At once Moses stretched his rod out over the land of Egypt, and Jehovah caused an east wind to blow upon the land all that day and all night. The morning came, and the east wind carried the locusts. And the locusts began to come up over all the land of Egypt and to settle down upon all the territory of Egypt. They were very burdensome. Before them there had never turned up in this way locusts like them, and there will never turn up any in this way after them. And they went covering the visible surface of the entire land, and the land grew dark, and they went on, eating up all the vegetation of the land, and all the fruit of the trees that the hail had left. And there was left nothing green on the trees or on the vegetation of the field in all the land of Egypt. So Pharaoh hurriedly called Moses and Aaron and said, I have sinned against Jehovah your God and against you. And now pardon, please, my sin just this once, and entreat Jehovah your God that he may turn away just this deadly plague from upon me. So he went out from Pharaoh and made entreaty to Jehovah. Then Jehovah made a shift to a very stiff west wind, and it carried the locusts away and drove them into the Red Sea. Not a single locust was let remain in all the territory of Egypt. However, Jehovah let Pharaoh's heart become obstinate, and he did not send the sons of Israel away. Jehovah then said to Moses, stretch your hand out toward the heavens, that darkness may occur over the land of Egypt, and the darkness may be felt. Moses immediately stretched his hand out toward the heavens, and a gloomy darkness began to occur in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, and none of them got up from his own place. 3 days. But for all the sons of Israel, there proved to be light in their dwellings. After that, Pharaoh called Moses and said, go, serve Jehovah. Only your sheep and your cattle will be detained. Your little ones also may go with you. But Moses said, you yourself will also give into our hands sacrifices and burnt offerings, as we must render them to Jehovah our God. And our livestock will also go with us. Not a hoof will be allowed to remain, because it is from them that we shall take some to worship Jehovah our God. And we ourselves do not know what we shall render in worship to Jehovah until our arriving there. At this, Jehovah let Pharaoh's heart become obstinate, and he did not consent to send them away. So Pharaoh said to him, get out from me. Watch yourself. Do not try to see my face again, because on the day of your seeing my face, you will die. To this Moses said, that is the way you have spoken. I shall not try to see your face any more. That's the end of Exodus chapter 10. Thank you for listening and watching, little children. I hope you enjoyed this. And may we continue to see the blessings of Jehovah from day to day in his undeserved kindness upon us through also his Son, also a mighty God, Christ Jesus. Today, we have a new member of the family that I mentioned yesterday. This is Willie. Willie's a steel dive watch, and it has the movement from China called a PT-5000 movement, which is a replica of a Swiss movement. One of the Swiss movements. It's a date. It has a date complication, so it can give me the day of the month. And currently it's the 28th. Willie has run 7 seconds fast in 24 hours. And this is Moppy. And Moppy also runs fast by quite a few seconds per day. The number precisely, I don't recall now, whether it's could be as high as 14 seconds, I believe, something significant per day. And I've not regulated either of these watches. Nor have I been able to regulate any of my watches yet, because I don't have the equipment to do that yet. So, but also these are not broken in. So we'll have to see. But one thing about Willie, this is a Captain Willard homage to the Captain Willard watch, which I believe was a Seiko watch, perhaps, if I'm not mistaken. But it was a Captain Willard that it was made to replicate. Now, the loom on this watch is beautiful. This is Willie. The loom here is really bright, and it's a different color on the bezel from what it is on the dial. It's a blue, beautiful blue color on the bezel. And on the dial, it's a beautiful green. So it's got these two shades of color that are just marvelous to witness when we see the nighttime view of this watch. It's far, far brighter than the lume on the on this excellent watch as well. The movement in this watch is an NH35, which is a Seiko movement. They're both automatic movements, which means that you don't have to wind them if you're wearing them. They wind themselves automatically. But this is a Chinese movement, and there have been some amazing things stated, remarkable things said about the accuracy and the quality of this Chinese movement. So, and this watch cost me $138 Canadian dollars on AliExpress, $138, which is a phenomenally low price. And that is particularly true of the Chinese watches on AliExpress. So for Ward Green, it's Willie and Moppy saying, I love you. Have a wonderful day. Praise Jehovah and may Jehovah bless you. And may his son Jesus serve as a wonderful counselor for you. Bye for now.